Drive Time on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Zurich. For pensions, protection, savings and investments. At Zurich, we deal in peace of mind.
A US trauma surgeon who recently volunteered in Gaza described the situation as a rain of fire and death during testimony to the UN Security Council this week. His testimony and the following interview is extremely powerful, but a warning that some may find it distressing. Dr. Feroz Sidwa recounted the horrors he witnessed, talking about personally treating 13 children who had been shot in the head during his two-week stay. He made an impassioned plea to the Security Council for an immediate ceasefire or risk the collapse of our collective conscience. Before coming on air, I spoke with Dr. Sidwa and asked him first what he witnessed on March 18th in Gaza.
That was March 18th of this year. I was I'd been in Gaza since March 6th, and it was the ceasefire was on, and there were still, you know, the Israelis were still shooting people, and but we would every day was basically like a busy day here in California, like not something that was unmanageable. But then at 2:30 in the morning, Israel resumed its widespread bombing campaign of Gaza, and that was the biggest mass casualty event I've ever seen in my life. It was absolute. It was just orders of magnitude above anything I've also seen.
Like what? You know, I was how do you factor that? I mean, how do you realize?
Yeah,
that that's
happening? For example, I was a resident during the Boston Marathon bombing in 2013, and every hospital in Boston that treated patients from that day considers it to be this wild event. You know, oh my God, how did we get through it? It's just incredible. We're all so amazing. And it was tough. It was, it was very busy that day. We felt overwhelmed for sure. But just look at the numbers, and they're kind of interesting. If you look at all of the level one trauma centers, meaning the best hospitals there are, all of the level one trauma centers in Boston together, there's six of them. Mm-hmm. And combined, they have about 4,000 beds, I think about 400 operating rooms, something like 300 surgeons who are capable of doing trauma. Huge, huge amount of resources. And so just like think about the 4,000 hospital beds. They saw 129 patients altogether. Nasser Medical Complex has, technically it has 250 beds. There are 200 extra tent beds outside, but whatever. Mm-hmm. So let's just say it has 450 beds. Nasser Medical Complex with with 10 times less beds than all those hospitals combined, saw 221 patients on just the morning of March 18th. So, you know, and we had six surgeons, six operating rooms, three anesthesiologists. You know, it was completely
and little
crazy
equipment, doctors.
And limited equipment for sure. Yeah. Now, you know, my job, like I mentioned, my job as a trauma surgeon is really to stop people from bleeding to death, to stabilize them, so that then, the neurosurgeon, the orthopedic surgeon, the facial plastic surgeon, those people can go to work. Usually not that day if they're severely injured, but later. And so I can do. You know, there aren't very many people that I can't stop from bleeding to death if I can get them up to the operating room in time. But the reconstructive options are they're almost zero at this point. I mean, it's impossible to reconstruct.
Why?
Well, because of the starvation of the hospitals, and because of the starvation of the people as well. So when the population is this malnourished, which, you know, the Palestinians have not eaten normally since October 7th of 2023. It's important for people to remember they've gone through repeated starvation and feeding cycles, which is actually never been done to any other population before, so we don't know what effect it'll have. Everyone is thin. There was actually just another actual on the ground survey study published showing that the average weight loss over the past 19 months is about, I think it was about 22 or 23 pounds. I think it was 11 kilos. But that's the average. You know, some people have lost way more. Some people have lost less. It depends on how privileged you are, how much access you can get to food, how much money you have, who you know. You know, these are all mm-hmm. circumstantial factors in determining who eats and who doesn't when resources are scarce.
What I cannot get over, what I cannot deal with, I must say, is some of your testimony. I think you said this to the UN, or you've certainly spoken about it previously as well, is in relation to that mass trauma event that you reference. You also talk about the number of children who were shot in the head. And you say, I think you personally treated 13 such cases in 2 weeks at the European hospital. Have I got that right?
Yeah, I try to be as conservative as I can with these things. So I just go by what I recorded in my journal from when I was dose at European Hospital. So, and I recorded that I treated 13 such cases. And we're not talking about 17-year-old boys. So we're talking about pre-teenage children, you know, 12 and under.
Yes, the difficulty here is very early on, we were told by the IDF or Israel that, you know, it is unfortunate there is sometimes collateral damage during the war. But when you have numbers such as on one day, 13 children being shot in the head, it's no longer acceptable, would you say, an excuse like that?
Yeah, well, you know, again, it doesn't, like, my one experience could be an isolated event, right? Or someone else's. But I did a poll of 65 American healthcare workers who worked in Gaza since October 7th. And I'm trying to remember, I think 53 said that they actually worked in the correct context. So, like, you know, they didn't work in a clinic somewhere because no one's going to see children shot in the head in the clinic. But the, you know, they're an emergency room doctor or a neurosurgeon or a trauma surgeon or an operating room person or an anesthesiologist or a critical care doctor. And they saw, so they, in other words, they would have been exposed to such children. And I think it was 80 something percent of them said that they regularly saw small children shot in the head or the chest. Well, so that, so basically in the catchment area of every hospital in the Gaza Strip, whenever there's an international person around, children are being shot in the head or the chest on a regular or daily basis. That can't possibly be an accident. The Gaza Strip's a very small place.
But then on top of that, then you have testimony of children asking, why didn't I die with my sister or my mother or my father? I mean, where do you go with this? I mean, this is just off the Richter scale, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, no, one of the other things I said there, or maybe I did, maybe I said it at the UN, maybe I didn't, I can't remember. But one of the things I tell people is that nobody really knows what this type of trauma is going to do to a whole generation of children. It's beyond extreme. I mean, you can't really find any other place in history where this kind of sustained viciousness or this level of extreme violence and viciousness and deprivation have been sustained for this long. Because you have to remember, Gaza was not some sparkling paradise on October 7th of 2023. It was a hellhole. And, you know, people were already hungry. Children's development was already being impacted by hunger even then. But at least it was not a place where, you know, bombs were falling out of the sky constantly. Displacement was an every 2 month event, meaning like your home is destroyed and you have to run for your life. See, you know, these children see their parents frightened literally all the time. You know, some people have thought I was exaggerating or like making up a story for effect when I said at the UN that parents memorize what their children are wearing in case their bodies are so mangled that they can't be identified. Like, you know, like, because these bombs are, the bombs the U.S. is giving Israel to drop in Gaza are enormously powerful. They rip people to shreds. They rip their heads off. It's incredible. And children are much more vulnerable to that kind of thing just because they're small. You know, they also have large heads. There's plenty of decapitated children throughout Gaza.
We were talking about children, babies, really, some of them. Pre-teens were shot in the head. You've talked as well about another case that has been etched in your mind. This is Ibrahim, a slain teenager you operated on March the 23rd. Can you tell me about him?
Yeah, Ibrahim. So he came into the hospital during the mass casualty of March 18th. He was the very last person I operated on that day. He had injuries to his colon and his rectum. And so I opened his abdomen, stopped him from bleeding, gave him a colostomy where the intestine comes out to the skin so everything else can heal. On March 23rd, 5 days later, he was doing quite well. The next day, he was going to go home. So at about, I think it was 9 o'clock at night, I went down to see him. So we lived on the fourth floor of the hospital. That's the EMT. He had living quarters, and then his room was on the second floor. So I went over to the stairs, was going to go down, and one of the doctors in the ICU pulled me into the ICU and said, "Hey, there's this other guy, Muhammad, who's bleeding. Can you take a look at him?" He was also a 16-year-old boy. So I looked at him. And yeah, sure enough, he was bleeding. I needed to go to the operating room. So I said, let's just, you know, set, I told the ICU staff, I just said, set him up to go to the operating room. I'm going to go change Ibrahim's bandages because who knows when we'll get out of the operating room. It might be so late that he's asleep. And then I'll be back and we'll go and take care of this kid, Muhammad. And as I walked out of the ICU, Ibrahim's room exploded. The Israelis fired a missile at it. They were very proud of it. They didn't try to pretend it was Hamas or something like that. And they did this to kill some guy named Ismail Barhum that they insisted was the prime minister of Gaza. And they insisted had been using the hospital to plan terrorism, which is just completely ridiculous. That guy was admitted just a few hours before he was killed. The ward that the men's surgical ward is where half of my patients were. I was there all the time. Mm-hmm. There was no, this guy just wasn't there. But Ibrahim and Ismail Barhum were from the same extended family. They were like distant cousins or something. Mm-hmm. So the nursing staff had put them into the same room just for family visits are easier and things like that. So this explosion happens. The hospital was in lockdown for about an hour. And then when the lockdown was lifted, I went down to the ER to see if there were anybody who needed to be operated on. And they said, no, only one person died. And I just remember thinking, how could only one person have died when you blow up an entire surgical ward? And then as I was thinking that, these three or four guys ran down the stairs with a body in a sheet. So I just directed them, because you couldn't examine anybody in the ward. It was completely destroyed. The lights aren't working. Mm-hmm. There's rubble everywhere. Mm-hmm. So I directed them into the trauma bay. And when I pulled the sheet open, I recognized Ibrahim's abdomen. His belly was eviscerated. Meaning his intestines were outside of him. His colostomy had been torn. He had been dead for an hour at that point. Yeah, there's nothing we could do about it.
And how do you react to that?
Oh, I mean, I was very, very. It's a combination of anger and, you know, there's the technical frustration of like, you know, I fixed this kid. It went well. I wanted him to go home. For me, especially being an American, the major reaction that I have to all of this is that it's so completely preventable. My government doesn't need to be sending any of these weapons.
In Ireland, our Taoiseach, the Prime Minister, the Taoiseach, the Deputy Prime Minister, our President has called what's happening in Gaza genocide. We don't have a ruling from the International Court of Justice to say it's genocide yet. Can you describe it as genocide?
I hate to say yes or no just because I don't know what the International Court of Justice will determine. But that's a technical legal question, right? From the standpoint of what any normal human being thinks of as genocide, forget the legal definitions. I'm talking about just what normal people go around saying. Genocide is basically an attempt to kill huge numbers of people because you don't like who they are. Of course, that's how. Not only does that meet the definition of, or not only does this attack meet the definition in that case, but genocide scholars were actually debating whether or not what Israel was doing in Gaza was genocidal prior to October 7th.
I think you've put it well. It almost meets the vernacular understanding of genocide as opposed to the legal threshold of genocide, which is being thrashed out at the ICJ.
What I just want people to understand is like it doesn't. Of course, it matters if it's genocidal or not, because genocide is the ultimate crime, really. But the big question is, are you for or against destroying every single structure in an entire society? Are you for or against burning children alive in their schools? Are you for or against shooting babies in the head?
Dr. Feroz Sidwa, thank you so much indeed for joining us.
Thank you, sir. Take care.